This is an interview with Richard Major and Joe Kyrgios on the 30th of April at the Australian Museum for the Shared Terrain Oral History Project on behalf of the City of Sydney History Unit. And Richard, can I have your full name and year of birth?
Okay, Richard Major, 1961.
Thank you. Okay, so can we start with some personal background, where you came from and what are some of your influences that have brought you into this role? And let's start there to get a bit of a context of, okay, about you.
All right. Well, I was born and raised in Sydney in Wurrunga. And from very early age, I was interested in fish particularly. I was influenced by Jacques Cousteau on the television, and right from primary school I wanted to be a marine biologist was my goal. And I think I was very fortunate to have some goal like that, because I found it very easy going through school and going to university knowing exactly what to do with my life. At the end of first year university, when I was going to go off to Heron Island diving, I went to get my medical certificate, and the doctor wouldn't give me one because of my asthma. And at the time, I suppose, I mean, nowadays I guess I'd go to another doctor, but at the time, the son of one of my father's colleagues had an asthma attack and died underwater the same week that I had that. So it was one of those things I sort of took seriously and thought, oh, well, I'm not going to study fish if I can't spend time under the water, so I'll look for something else. And I switched over to birds. So I'm not one of those people, you know, born with binoculars embedded in my skull. I sort of switched to birds at the end of first year of university. Actually, probably a bit later. I sort of, you know, scouted around and looked for things. And by the end of, you know, by the time I was starting honours, I was quite keen in birds. I still did my honours in partially in fish and partly on plants. But at the end of that, I decided I really wanted to do a project on the ecology of a single species of bird. And I left Sydney and went to Monash University, and I did a PhD on the ecology of the white-fronted chat.
Huh. Hence the article on the white-fronted chat. Why birds, though? What happened there in your choices?
I think it's probably things that the plants and animals you grow up with, I think, quite influential. I was lived right on the edge of the bush, and I used to, you know, after school I'd go and play in the bush, and so I would, you know, see things there, and I became very interested in the flora of Sydney too, and the sandstone vegetation. A bird that really struck me at that stage was the pied currawong, which is at that stage I thought it was fantastic, because it would, you know, come around and peck on the milk bottles and get the cream out of the milk bottles. We had big flocks of currawongs coming through the suburbs and feeding on cotone asters and things and dumping on our deck. And actually, I was quite keen on, I wanted to do a PhD on currawongs while I was at Sydney Uni, so while I was still doing my undergraduate, but I was sort of strongly advised against a bird project for an honours thesis at the time. So anyway, I was quite influenced by early television documentaries. I mentioned Jacques Cousteau before, but also things like Wild Kingdom, and I liked furry mammals and birds and big things like that. I think I was, you know, attracted to these, you know, flamboyant vertebrates, and I hadn't really got, you know, considered invertebrates much at that stage.
And so you went to Sydney? No, that's right.
I went to Sydney Uni for my undergraduate degree, and I did honours at Sydney Uni, and then I went down to Monash University in Melbourne and did my PhD down there. And then after my PhD, I came back up to Sydney too.
And so what is your work background then? Tell me a bit about that.
Well, at the end of my PhD, I did a consultancy on Norfolk Island, where I worked on the Norfolk Island scarlet robin, which is a threatened species nationally. So that I did a little bit of work on that. I did a little bit of work at Sydney University in their first year biology department, and then I got a postdoc position at the Australian Museum, and I've spent a few years on that, and then I got a permanent position, and so really I haven't worked very much else. So I've been at the Australian Museum now for 22 years.
And what's the title of your position?
My title of my position is Senior Research Scientist. I was employed as a terrestrial ecologist, but you know, as departments change with time, I'm now in an amalgamated department in with terrestrial vertebrates. So I guess I'm now a sort of bird researcher, whereas my formative position here was as an ecologist, where I studied things a bit more broadly than birds. So I have done some projects on insects and spiders as well, but primarily I've worked on birds ever since my PhD.
So tell me about the sorts of projects that you've been doing, and then if I've got it right, we move into more urban birds. So give me some of that history.
Okay, so I guess I'm really interested in population ecology. So I like studying the ecology of single species, and I guess I'm very privileged to do so, to sort of get into the private life of a bird. I started that with my white-fronted chats. I've worked on the scarlet robins, New Holland honeyeaters, red-capped robins, a bunch of different species where I sort of look at all sorts of things about them, their breeding biology, their feeding biology, trying to look at their habitat use, how long they live, that sort of stuff. In particular, I've been looking at the effects of human activities on animals and particularly birds. And so some of the big processes that I've looked at have been habitat fragmentation, and urbanisation is one of the forms of land clearance that leads to fragmentation. So I guess I've had two big research projects since I've been at the museum, or just two main drives. One was looking at habitat fragmentation, and then the other is urbanisation. The fragmentation work I did out in the wheat belt of New South Wales, so that was looking at the distribution of birds in small patches of woodland that remain after they've been cleared for agriculture, so looking at the birds inhabiting small patches of woodland, largely in the wheat belt, so surrounded by sheep and wheat production country. Mm-hmm. And there I also studied red-capped robins in particular as a small bird, which was sort of typical of those that are declining. So I looked at the population ecology of those. Did some work on spiders and insects as well to see if they were affected in the same way as birds. And then nearly 10 years, I've been just switched to urbanisation as a process, and looked at the ecology of birds in urban environments. So, and I've done that particularly in collaboration with Birds Australia and the Birds in Backyards project, and a number of students from various universities around Sydney.
And so the Birds in Backyards project, is that actually an Australian Museum project, or did that come out of a broader... The Birds Australia.
It's had some history to it. It's started as a Birds Australia Sydney group project, then and I was on the steering committee for that. Then there was a sort of time when the museum could put a bit more work into that, and we formed a partnership between the Australian Museum and Birds Australia, and that's when we sort of got the website going first of all, and our first surveys, and so together we got the project sort of really running, as a very active project, and that partnership lasted a few years, and then the museum sort of pulled back from the sort of bigger involvement it had in, so it's now just managed by Birds Australia, so it's reverted back to Birds Australia, and I'm back on the steering committee still, so it's sort of come around full circle. So there was a time there when the Australian Museum was a partner in the project, but it started as a Birds Australia project, and it's now still going as a Birds Australia project.
Well, tell me about that project and what sorts of results and findings that you've had, especially as it relates to Sydney. And I mean, obviously, I realise that you can't fix it around LGA boundaries, but where we can, see what we find about the LGA.
Okay, well, the sort of motivation for that project was an educational one, that we felt that there are some very serious environmental issues happening in Australia, that generally there isn't a high level of public interest or understanding in, and the people on that Birds in Backyards project thought, well, the way to get people interested in big environmental issues is to introduce them to things that they're already familiar with and build from that. And so I thought, well, the animals that they have sort of share their day-to-day lives with are the best place to start. And there are a number of issues that we can sort of illustrate through what's happening in people's gardens that apply at a bigger scale. So some of the things that we've looked at are habitat loss, so the effect of clearing, and then that, again, that fragmentation, that the native animals tend to be left in small patches of habitat, little streamside corridors or little remnants of land or the national parks on the edges of cities. And so we were able to talk about that issue of fragmentation. So I've had a number of students working on particular projects, so they've documented things like the difference in species occupying large patches of bush on the edge of Sydney with smaller remnants within Sydney, and again with the birds that are able to actually cope in people's backyards as well. So it's an urban project. And we've tried to collect data on what people's gardens are like, so the structure of people's gardens in terms of what percentage of the garden is made up of trees or shrubs or grass or pavers, hard surfaces, how many trees they have in their garden, whether they have native and exotic plants. And again, we've tried to relate the birds that are present in gardens with the habitat within people's gardens. Generally, it's quite a hard thing to do, and there really aren't a lot of native birds that you find in gardens that are sort of closer to the city. So if you look at the birds that we find in people's gardens, there's two types. There's those that are really like to live in the native habitat nearby, but can make incursions into the built environment, and they can get some of their resources within them. And then there are some other species that have welcomed this new habitat and are thriving in the new habitat provided by suburbia. So I think some of the things that would be most striking for this, and if we take a historical perspective too, say the pied currawong, which was a bird that I was very interested in even at university, at my undergrad years, used not to be found breeding in Sydney at all. It would seem to come down from the Blue Mountains, where it bred, and then during the autumn and winter it would make use of people's gardens, particularly the introduced berry-producing plants. So we have large certain things we provide in gardens which provide good food resources. And so currawongs are something, a big bird that could move around, nest where it traditionally did in the mountains, and exploit these extra food options. And so we used to get large flocks of currawongs. Since then, over the last probably 40 years, currawongs are now breeding, and they're the most commonly recorded. We did a breeding survey as part of Birds in Backyards, and the currawong is the second most commonly recorded bird breeding in Sydney. So I've seen changes. So some species have learnt to exploit new options in suburbia. So we still provide currawongs with nesting habitat in terms of tall trees and big food resources in terms of berries.
And so when you were talking about as a young person seeing those flocks, they were just passing through, were they, or were they already starting to change their behaviour?
Stage, so that would have been, the time I was interested would have been early 1970s, and I don't think we had breeding, I can't be exactly sure of it, but I think the breeding records of Currongs, about 1975 we first started to get breeding records, and there were not very many of them. It's been, you know, the last 20 years probably that the numbers of breeding birds have really increased, so that Currawongs are staying here year round. I mean, I think it's partially a catch up time. You know, takes time for populations to, you know, grow and learn. The other interesting side of the Currawong story is that we now get more channel bill cuckoos, which is a nest parasite. So they're a cuckoo that lay their eggs in the nests of currawongs particularly, and then the currawongs bring up the channel bill cuckoo babies. We've got a specific channel bill cuckoo survey on the Birds in Backyards website, and that's sort of documenting changes in channel bill numbers over time. So they've now tracked the currawongs. When currawongs weren't breeding in Sydney, we didn't really get channel bill cuckoos. Now channel bill cuckoos are something that, you know, is very widely noticed by urban residents right through into, you know, Hyde Park at the time of year when channel bill cuckoos come through. There's channel bill cuckoos at Hyde Park and Belmore Park next to Central Railway Station, probably around the university, I'm not sure, but they're something that comes right through the city, tracking changes in currawongs.
And do people notice the channel bill cuckoos because of their call? Or?
Yeah, so they have a very loud, quite raucous call, which they'll make when flying over to or sitting in trees. And it's interesting, the coel is another cuckoo, which is also becoming more common in urban areas, which also makes a very loud call. So they're two species which are, you know, very well known by people, not for the best of reasons, during the breeding season each year, which is partially why we chose them for surveys on the Birds in Backyards website. We're sort of working from things that people were interested in, and you know, we've had very good channel bill and coel survey records, you know, not only just tracking when the first ones arrive, but people recording behaviour and mating behaviour and foraging and all sorts of stuff.
And so what are the reasons why the numbers have increased? It can't just be because... Is it just because the currawong numbers have increased?
Well, in the case of the channel bill cuckoo, I suspect the numbers, why they're more around Sydney and in the urban areas, because of the currawongs. I don't know what their situation is, you know, Australia wide as to whether they're increasing or not, but it's something that is definitely more noticeable in Sydney that would happen. I mean, it has to be correlated with the increase in currawong breeding, because they just wouldn't be here if there weren't currawongs for them to nest in. Mm. The it's probably a similar story with the coel as well, in that they parasitise some other birds that do, the nests of other birds that do quite well in Sydney. So they parasitise nests of wattle birds and also magpie larks. So wattle birds, they're large honey eaters. We've got two species of the little wattle bird and the red wattle bird in Sydney. They're a very well-known component of many people's gardens. They're a very strongly nectivorous honey eater. I mean, honey eaters, you would think by name, should feed on nectar, but lots of them spend a lot of their time eating insects and even fruit, some of them. The wattle birds are really strongly nectar-dependent, and I think they have benefited from the sort of things we plant in gardens. You know, we are gardeners like floral displays, so they like things to produce flowers. We also like protracted flowering seasons. We like to, you know, have things flowering for as long as possible. So what seems to have happened with the wattle birds is that we have this year-round copious nectar source, and that tends to favour larger honey eaters and more nectar dependent ones. So, you know, honey eaters are interesting birds. They tend to track nectar, so they'll track eucalypt flowering, for instance. But the ones that do that tend to be the smaller ones, whereas the larger and more aggressive ones seem to do better on, seem to dominate more continuous nectar sources. So I think urban areas are quite good at providing continuous nectar sources, and so we see the wattle birds doing well, and again the coels parasitise their nests, and so there we're seeing more of them than we used to as well.
And so what are the reasons that the currawongs have also done so well?
I think the main one is the berry-producing plants, which first were used as ornamentals, but also which have now escaped into bushland. So the currawongs eat the fruits and deposit the seeds, and if they're tracking between people's gardens and bushland remnants, they're depositing seeds in the bushland. So we now have a lot of weeds, things like, well, a lot of the typical weeds like privets and lantanas and blackberries and camphor laurels, what else, ochnas. It's a whole range of berry producing plants that are fantastic food for currawongs, and we produce them, provide them initially, but now they've spread as weeds. So I think there's that large food resource that used not to be here.
So am I understanding it correctly that we humans, in the way that gardens have developed and perhaps other plantings in public spaces and things, have actually been the reason for why some types of birds have come into the city when they weren't here before, is it?
Yeah, well, they might have been here before, right, but have now sort of dominated. They're now, you'll now find wattle birds in some suburbs of Sydney in greater abundance than they would be in their nearby native habitats, which implies there's a larger amount of resource for them. I think the classic one, and probably the most important bird in Sydney for determining what other birds live here, is the noisy miner. That's another native honey eater. It often gets confused with the introduced Indian miner, which is the brown bird. It's the one that I think is particularly important is the native honey eater, the noisy miner. That's the grey one. And they live in sort of colonies. They're communal breeders. There'll be a family group that provides the food to a single nest, and they defend that nest. And they're very, very aggressive. They're called hyper-aggressive birds, in that anything smaller than them and lots of things bigger than them, they will drive out of their territories. And you see them around in Hyde Park here chasing
currawongs.
Also ibis is quite funny. The ibis will just sort of keep ducking, and they'll come down over and over and over again at them. They sort of can't drive them away, but so when they get something into their brain that they're going to chase off, they do. But anything smaller than them, so that right across the eastern side of Australia, so through the woodlands of Australia, and particularly in urban areas, but also in lots of woodlands and the fragmented patches of woodland in eastern Australia, particularly the roadside remnants and the new plantings people are doing to try and link patches, biodiversity corridors, unfortunately, from a bird perspective, seem to be being dominated by noisy miners, which will just exclude all the small birds that these corridors are being built for. And it's particularly obvious in Sydney, where we've really lost most of our small insectivores and small honey eaters, but across much of Sydney you'll hear noisy miners calling, and you'll even witness a lot of aggression between noisy miners and other birds. So they're another species that has really likes the habitat that we provide in urban areas. There's sort of various theories about this. A popular one is that it's that nectar resource that we're providing in gardens might be supporting these honey eaters. I've had a student who looked at that, so compared gardens with grevilleas in them, with gardens without, and there's a much tighter relationship between the presence of miners and eucalypts, so gum trees, than there is with the grevilleas. So I guess my thoughts are that they like the habitat structure most, that the gum trees are important, but then that barer understory, so that we don't have a lot of shrubs, but it's that grass with trees in it that seems to make perfect noisy miner habitat. And I think it's partially because it's defensible. They can see anything that comes into the territory quickly, and but it provides the food resources they need in the eucalypts too. So coming back to birds in backyards, this has sort of been the biggest challenge when people say, well, what can I do in my garden to bring back all the small birds? And unfortunately, birds aren't operating on the individual garden scale. It's the suburb that's the suburb scale that's important. So while we have parks, schools, golf courses, nature strips that are all trees with lawn underneath them, and many people's gardens are trees with lawn, we're going to be keeping noisy miners around, and so it's going to be very hard to bring back small insectivores and honey eaters no matter how good a job you do of revegetating your garden. So what we're trying to do in Birds in Backyards is try and get this awareness across of the importance of, you know, planning in larger spatial scales and improving the habitat of whole suburbs.
And why is it important to have that diversity of birds, the smaller birds? Why shouldn't we be just happy with currawongs and noisy miners and wattle birds?
Look, I think well, you're missing out on a lot. You know, those little birds are fantastic. To be realistic, it's going to be a very big effort to get them back. The reason why I'm keen to have them is because I think that is what this biodiversity is. You want to see a diversity of things, and people need to be exposed to a diversity of wildlife where they live. We can't expect people to take an interest in the bigger issues, wildlife issues, you know, beyond the cities, if people haven't got a wildlife ethic. And I think the only way you get a wildlife ethic is if you've got interesting biodiverse things happening near you. So maybe I'm painting too negative a picture when I say we've lost all the small birds. We actually have a lot of fantastic big birds. I mean, I think you're right. We should be happy to have channelbill cuckoos and coels and currawongs in the garden. And we're really lucky. We've got a fantastic array of parrots in Sydney. You know, overseas visitors coming in just, you know, can't believe it when they see sulfur-crested cockatoos and galahs and corellas and rainbow lorikeets and crimson rosellas, and another bunch of fantastic birds that we get in cities. That actually, a lot of those parrots are more common in cities now than they are in their natural habitat. They seem to be queuing into some of these same resources, the increased nectar resources in particular. For some of the parrots, but yeah, also I think they're affected by people feeding them as well. That the seed people put out, it's a different habitat. It does have diverse animals in there. I guess that does provide people a lot of joy to have parrots in their gardens, have all these things to feed the kookaburra or the butcher bird. That's all good. I'd like to see some small birds in there as well, but maybe that's just my prejudice.
Me too. But now, you were saying there was another category of birds that are doing all right, that they can fly in, use the resources and go out again. Is that because I think you said there were two categories of birds
that we find using urban areas. So there are some that can survive all their lives in there, and the wattle birds do that very well, the noisy miners do that. And then there's some birds that you'll only see on the periphery of either nature reserves or intact areas. So if you're closer to the bush, you'll get some birds like red-browed firetails coming into gardens, or some of the honey eaters, and silver eyes and yellow-faced honey eaters, and some of these things coming out and feeding in gardens and making use of the resource, but they're not really able to spend their whole life cycle there.
And so are there any places in the LGA that would have those types of birds that you were talking about?
There's this within the Sydney City LGA. Yeah, yeah. There's some places that have some birds you don't find, right across Sydney, and then some interesting things through Newtown. There are quite a few fairy wrens, smaller birds there. There's New Holland honeyeaters there, although I'm hearing from people that there's the noisy miners seem to be moving into those areas too, and as the noisy miners are going in, people are losing their New Holland honeyeaters.
In Newtown, what sort of areas? Is that because of Sydney Park, or where would those little birds...
I've just heard from people actually in their backyards, and it seems to have been that in some of those areas there might not be a lot of... it's not like people have big backyards, but they didn't have a lot of eucalypts. Whereas, say, the North Shore, people think of the North Shore of Sydney as this lovely, leafy North Shore that must be full of wildlife. Actually, it's got lots of eucalypts and lots of lawns and is real noisy miner capital. And so, in Birds in Backyard surveys, we found, more fairy wrens, for instance, in Newtown than we do on the North Shore.
And other examples?
I'm trying to think of some small birds in the LGA. We see sort of willy wagtails across the place. They're not really a bird that's coming out of the bushland. They do quite well when there's patches of, they feed in open areas, grassy park areas too. No.
So, do you think there's some hope of getting rid of the noisy miners and actually shifting that balance back towards habitat that will support the little birds?
Look, I think there is some hope, and I do think the noisy miner is a special case. There's some things I think, if there's a bird that does well in an urban area, well, good for it. It's good that something does, and to leave it to its own devices and celebrate it thriving. The issue of the noisy miner is that it's not just in urban areas that it's a problem, and it is really a serious problem for a lot of woodland birds that are declining, that are now on the threatened species list. So there is a group in Australia, a group of scientists that are actually working on the noisy miner issue at the moment to try and identify what could be done in two habitats to make them less suitable for noisy miners. And I feel it is a big enough problem. There's going to be quite a bit of work done on that, so that there might be some... it might be a reasonable one to tackle within urban areas. It still comes back to people's values too, though, as to how much people care about them. And I'm talking from my perspective here, where I think the ultimate bit of gardening is to grow a fairy wren in your garden, is to have them then come into you. But it is very much your values, and they're mine, but we've got to put a lot of people in the place, in the city, and it's a question as to, are you best to have a big sacrificial landscape of a city and not worry about the wildlife in it, and better to do that than sprawl out across the rest of the country, is one thought on it. I don't think that's the way to go, because I think we then just become so disconnected with wildlife that it's hard to look after it in those other places. So my feelings are that we need to try and keep diversity where we live.
Thank you. Yes, there were some things that I was going to talk about with you. And I want to know about the Currawongs, because you did send me that article on Currawongs, and I must say I had no idea quite how many small birds they actually eat. So you wouldn't, you think that Currawongs, let me ask you about Currawongs, are they also to somewhat be celebrated and left to their own devices?
Well, it's the same situation as the noisy miner. There's a terrific bird, the Currawong, beautiful call, striking bird. They're intelligent, they're, you know, lovely to have around. They might, I think it's 2 kilograms of nestlings they have to eat of other birds in order to produce one clutch of their own. So they're very efficient predators. It's sort of getting to the stage now, though, where I'm not sure that they're going to be taking too many small birds in Sydney, because I don't think there's that many of them left. So they'll be looking at other food sources. I mentioned early that they, you know, used to feed on milk bottles when they were delivered. I think we'll still see a lot of dynamism within birds, and things will change. Someone was suggesting to me last year that Currawong numbers are actually declining a bit in the city. I haven't really seen any, you know, sort of data that supports that, but some of these, you know, anecdotal things often turn out to be the case. We might be seeing the situation now that the channel bill cuckoos are getting their own back, so we're not getting the production of Currawongs that we used to. But generally, I wouldn't like us to sort of declare open season on, you know, birds for being too abundant, and us saying, well, you know, we don't like them, so we're going to go and shoot them or poison them and that. I really think it's up, if we think there's too many Currawongs around or too many noisy miners around, the approach should be to look at how we've changed the habitat and think how the habitat should be. So we could do a lot to combat the Currawong issue by, you know, more bush regeneration, getting rid of some of those you know, big berry-producing plants from our gardens. These will take time, and I think they do. I think we are seeing change all the time in that regard.
And now I think you have done some historical research on birds in the Sydney region. Is that right? Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, well, trying to find out if they're... I've actually already spoken about the small birds declining, but I was trying to get some hard evidence of the small bird decline. So one way of getting at that question was to look at what might have been in Sydney a long time ago and what's is here now, and thought, well, it's our museum records. We've got collections in our cabinets here going back into the 1800s. We've got a lot of specimens from the 1800s. And so I did with Holly Parsons. We looked at all the records of birds in our collection prior to 1900 and compared those with the surveys by, not by Birds in Backyards, but by the Birds Australia Atlas. So these are actually well-experienced bird observers, to look at what was here now. And it sort of very clearly showed that there were, you know, lots of small birds in Sydney in the 1800s and the early 1900s, although really our focus was the 1800s. So we had, you know, lots of things, lots of flycatchers, thornbills, robins, wrens, all those small birds, lots of little honey eaters too, were quite common in the collection. We didn't have a noisy miner record collection from Sydney. We didn't have a rainbow lorikeet from the Sydney region, but lots of these small birds, and the ones that were, so really it showed that the birds that have declined have been the small, mostly insectivores. The ones that have increased have tended to be the parrots and the larger carnivores, things like butcher birds, currawongs, magpies too, which makes quite a lot of sense if you think of the foods that a lot of the small birds are insectivorous. At one level, we don't like insects, people. You know, so you could say there's been lots of pesticides. I don't know what our insect abundances are like now, but we don't like insects, and we don't provide the habitat for insects particularly well either. So there's some of these birds like to feed amongst leaf litter or feed in dense understory shrubs, that insect layer again. So the food's unavailable and the shelter isn't available for them. But then for things that eat small food packages and small insects, but larger birds, whether they be the parrots or the larger carnivores, humans tend to provide a bit of food in that regard. We actually feed things directly with, you know, macroscopic things, things that we can see. They can feed on, you know, carrion, garbage, larger food items, and the larger birds are the one that's done well. So that's the historic research I've done, was just trying to look at whether there's particular guilds of birds which have changed. So,
and you found that. And what about introduced birds and the relationship between introduced birds and native birds, those that have managed well and maybe those that haven't? Can you give me a history of that?
Well, there's a number of introduced birds that are now doing very well in Sydney. The most notable one would be the Indian miner. We also have sparrows, although their numbers have come and gone a bit, and starlings and bulbuls. There's, you know, quite an array of introduced birds in Sydney. They, of course, if you looked in the museum collections in the 1800s, weren't in there because they hadn't been introduced and established. Nowadays, the Indian miner and the spotted turtle dove are, you know, probably some of the species that people in Sydney are most familiar with.
And when do they turn up?
Oh, look, there was an acclimatisation society that was deliberately bringing birds in. I'd have to look up the actual, you know, the dates, but there have been several introductions for many of those species in different cities around Australia. Mm-hmm. But no, I can't tell off the top of my head their dates.
But some of them are quite early. I was just wondering whether or not, aren't they? I mean,
yeah.
Some of those acclimatisation... So I was just, did the museum not collect anything that wasn't indigenous, or was it just that they just weren't?
They weren't. I don't think they'd become established at that stage. I think we had one sparrow. Again, I need to check that one, but I think it was one sparrow in the collection before, you know, 1900. But, just one thing is introducing them, but the next is having them established to the point where people would collect them. Yeah.
And what is their relationship to the native and indigenous birds? Do they also push some of them out or change that, what some of the birds can and can't, you know, where they can live?
I think that's a bit overrated, that idea. Certainly a very popular idea that introduced species are the sort of bane of the earth. I think that's a sort of a convenience that we do to take the pressure off our own responsibilities from creating poor quality habitats for them. So I think there's a lot of effort goes into control of Indian miners because we look at them and say, well, you know, this is something that's obviously introduced species. It's common, so it must be having a big impact on other animals. Whereas I think the successful introductions have been things that actually live very well with people and the habitats that people make. And so we find them and not the native birds in the space, often because we haven't got suitable habitat for the native birds, we have suitable habitat for the introduced birds, rather than the introduced birds driving the small ones, the native ones, away. So for the Indian miner, which is the most common, look, it's true, they will nest in tree hollows, And so for birds like parrots, which also nest in tree hollows, there's the possibility that they will take over hollows that parrots might like to use. However, I've got a student, Adrian Davis, who has been climbing trees and looking in hollows and put cameras in hollows in urban areas or urban remnants and in remnants in national parks. And so he's sort of monitored over 60 hollows with cameras and had about 1,200 visits from different animals to those hollows during the breeding season, and he had not one visit from an Indian miner. So that's the place where they're most likely to have the impact, and in Sydney at least, I don't see that happening. The other place that they're blamed for is for being aggressive towards other birds and small birds. Well, they're just not, particularly by comparison with the native miner, the noisy miner. I had a student, Katie Lowe, who did her honours looking at that, and she published a paper which showed that she measured aggression rates of different birds, and the Indian miner was just no more aggressive than any other background bird. And compared with wattle birds and noisy miners, their aggression was absolutely trivial. So I think they're these introduced birds are a convenient thing to blame things on. I'm not advocating them. I think exotic plants and animals have potential to do bad things, and they can often be sitting in a sleeper phase for a long time before the impact really shows. So I'm not saying we should look after and value them, but I think there's more urgent things to do in terms of habitat reconstruction than taking engineering type approaches and eliminating exotic birds.
One little bird that people seem to comment on that they don't see as many of are sparrows. Is that I come from South Australia. We just lived with sparrows everywhere. Is that the case in Sydney? I think you'd mentioned sparrows. Is that a bird that has disappeared as well?
Well, I remember sparrows as being really common as a kid in Sydney, and I don't see them that often now, but I see them in particular places. If anyone keeps chickens, I always see sparrows around where people keep chickens. I suspect, they have changed in abundance. They're much less common now. I think part of that is this change in people's activities and change in habitats too. Probably there's less of those areas with seeding grasses and things. But I suspect they've also been influenced by the noisy miner as well, that they're another small bird and they won't do well in areas where noisy miners are. They've declined a lot in London, the sparrows too. There's quite a bit of concern for sparrows in England. I think that's might be lead in petrol as the popular one. Some fuel additive. I would be surprised if it was the same thing happening here, but they have declined here as well.
And so insects, that would probably be one of them too, that just the same sorts of issues that you were talking about for the little native birds.
Yeah, although sparrows tend to be more a seed eater, so I think it's the insects actually in London that they were getting their toxic doses from. So whether that's happening here or not, I'm not sure. But I think some of it is just that change in the availability of seed. And I mentioned the chickens because I do think more people had backyard chickens too when I was growing up, and so there was always seed around for them. If you look at the grain terminal down at Port Kembla, it's full of them. There's various places where they're locally abundant and often seems to be around a good food resource.
And are there other key bird issues that we haven't covered that come to mind that impact here in the city?
Look, there's one that's dear to my heart. That's probably, it's a lost cause, but it's a nice example. I'm currently doing a project studying actually back on what I did my PhD on, so I've had the opportunity to come back 20 years on from my PhD on white-fronted chats to look at white-fronted chats in Sydney, where there's two little populations left. They're now listed as an endangered population in the Sydney region of this species, and it's now just confined to two populations, one at Sydney Olympic Park at Homebush Bay and one at Tower Point in Botany Bay. So they're just two little patches of salt. They're a salt marsh bird and they like swampy areas. But they were, if we look at the museum collections and early records of ornithologists going back into the 1800s, they were found in these sort of swampy areas right across Sydney, joining Homebush Bay through Ashfield and Enfield and down the Cooks's River all the way to Botany Bay. They were across through from Centennial Park over to Rose Bay. So we've got records of them from a lot of places. And sort of documented the decline of those, that just as their habitat has continued to get smaller and smaller, they've just become extinct until they've just confined to these last two habitat remnants left. So I mention that just because keeping the patches of intact habitat are very important for some species. And it's just a really nice example of documenting the decline, and I expect that species will become extinct in the Sydney region, in the not too distant future, and then we'll have a gap between Nowra and Newcastle along the coast for a species that was once quite common across the region. So it's sort of just a nice example of urbanisation in general and how it's a sort of slow, insidious process, and the time scale it takes.
Mm. And I guess talking about that whole issue of urban ecology and nature, what does nature mean to you and in the context of these urban environments that we're talking about?
Oh, I mean, I get a lot of inspiration from nature. Is that the sort of thing you mean?
Why is it important in a big city?
It just adds a lot of richness to my life, is to see stuff. I mean, I think humans aren't the greatest species on Earth. There's lots of variety there. I get a lot of joy about, when I walk up to the railway station and I see the scrub wren interacting with the yellow thornbill. Just, I don't know, there's a lot of people are fascinated by pets too. They add a lot to people's lives. Well, having a diversity of animals around for some people is something you get a lot of inspiration from. It's inspired poets and painters through the ages, inspires scientists too, and inspires just lots of people, gardeners, love having wildlife coming into their gardens. So it's just one of those things that enriches your life.
And what are the impacts that you see for the future of, given that you're saying that, really it's important to have biodiversity and lots of things in this urban environment? What are some of the ongoing concerns that you see into the future?
I guess we're going to still see more erosion of habitat. So we're going to see more subdivisions, smaller blocks, smaller gardens, more organised playing fields, more council mowers, more manicured. We do sort of, I think, humans generally like ordered landscapes that don't have the messiness and the habitat complexity that contributes to a wide species diversity. So I think we're going to see more habitat loss within cities. I think that's probably the biggest issue. I think there is potential to do to have better open spaces. I think we could be doing more in terms of planting shrub layers. That's the bit that seems to be missing. So there's a lot of degraded, you know, remnants along railway lines and parks and gullies and things like that that are not quite densely weed infested now, that we could put more of an effort into for wildlife. I think we can do more in our gardens. There is a potential to make that matrix more suitable for animals, even if we lose more habitat. But look, I'm not really familiar with all the places in the Sydney metropolitan area, and it might be a very useful case history to have a look at, because it has had the biggest impact over time, so it could be the early warning place. So I think it is important to survey the areas across Sydney that, you know, have got wildlife value, because we'll learn a lot from those from a much, much bigger footprint that we're probably heading towards in the future for a lot of Sydney.
Mm, yeah.
Can we... I have been talking to John about ibis, but one of the things I didn't ask him about was in the article you sent me, talked about lethally managed... That's how ibis have been managed in the past. What does that actually mean? That's what I wanted to ask.
I think it's a euphemism for saying that people are destroying ibis in various parts of Sydney where they're a nuisance animal. And so there's nest and egg destruction is the technique that is being used. I think that's actually rather a blunt instrument for dealing with the problem, because often if you destroy the nest of these things, it seems to be that they will nest again. And if they don't nest again, and sometimes it is perhaps effective in that if you've got ibis nesting over a cafe and dropping things in the cafe, if you repeatedly remove their nest and eggs, they will nest somewhere else, often nearby. So the next nearest palm tree they can find, they will move to that. But you've got to be quite persistent in order to discourage them. They might nest in that same place quite a few times. So that's one reason why you might do so, lethally manage. I think it's also used because people are saying, well, there's too many of them, and so we will reduce the number by nest and egg destruction. But I don't think it's something that a permit is required for, and so it'll never be done on the scale required to reduce numbers. So I don't think it's going to be effective in that way. Mm. The only way it's effective is if it just deters birds from nesting. Generally, what tends to be much more effective if there is a problem of birds, and I can see there's problems of ibis in particular locations, highly specific locations, and ultimately, it's get rid of what they're nesting in. So often they like nesting in palm trees in urban areas, date palms, and if there's a date palm in some place that you really don't want to have ibis nesting, well, if you get rid of the date palm, or in some places they prune the date palms, we call it pineappling because it ends up with a little sprout up the top. If you can sort of get rid of the things so there isn't a nesting platform, the birds will go. Generally, I think ibis are a fantastic bird in the parks. A lot of people just don't like them because they perceive them as being introduced, which they're not. They've moved into the city as the water has been, inland has been dominated for agricultural use. So they've moved into more reliable habitats where they're doing quite well. The majority of them, I think, are fairly benign. They do come close to people, but I think it's quite nice.
And now Angel Place, I still haven't managed to get there, but could you tell me about Angel Place and what's there and where it is?
Okay, Angel Place is down off Martin Place, and it's a few years ago, the City of Sydney did the Laneways exhibition, and a variety of artists, installation artists, put in proposals, which the City of Sydney supported, to put installations in the lane, in various laneways across Sydney, to make them more interesting. And an artist, Michael Hill, called me at the museum because he wanted to do an installation which reflected on the changes in the birds of Sydney from the time that Sydney was built. And he wanted some information on what birds might have been present in Angel Place, because that's where his proposal exhibition was. And he asked right at the time, when I was doing my work looking at the museum records, as to what the museum collected. So it was a really opportune time, and I sent him my draft paper on that, and he said, "Oh, wow, this is exactly what we want. Can you be on the team that put in the installation project?" So I was on that team as the scientific advisor for it, and Michael was the artist, and then he installed several hundred bird cages in Angel Place. And they're all empty bird cages, reflecting the loss of the birds in Sydney, and that plays from each bird cage. There's a song coming out of a species that might have once been inhabiting that place. So it's based on what the museum records told us would have been in those habitats within Sydney before 1900. And so, yes, as you walk through Angel Place, there's this soundscape of bird calls coming, and you look up and see these empty cages. I like it, and it's had very good reports. And since then, it was a temporary exhibition, and the City of Sydney then suggested that it be made permanent. So it's now been made into a permanent exhibition in Sydney. So go and have a look at it.
I definitely will. And do you think that sort of, do you think that is an educative process for some people?
People reflect on it, and you see them smiling, and you see them thinking. And yeah, I think there's, you know, we sort of scientists bang on about habitat loss and stuff, and you know, don't always get a good hearing, and we sound like a broken record some of the time. So I think all the different ways we can address these issues, the better, and I'm sure that one works a lot for a lot of people.
And I guess climate change is one of the things that people are more aware of. Have you got any comments about how that is going to influence how we live and the bird populations and the sorts of things that you work on?
I think it's an interesting one in terms of urban areas particularly, because for birds, I think water will be an increasingly short resource or scarce resource. I think we've already seen that with the ibis that we're now seeing in the city, which weren't here before 1970. They've responded to humans probably dominating the water, so there's now more water available in urban areas. I think we're going to see that with more things, dominating resources. I think it's one of the reasons why trees in urban areas are so attractive for noisy miners, because we actually have, we're dominating the water in the city, so they're well-watered, more productive trees a lot of the time. So I think global warming will have an effect on that, and that'll have an effect on urban areas. But generally, I think global warming just will intensify all the other issues that are already present. You know, so generally there are a lot of problems in terms of habitat loss and degradation and fragmentation, and global warming will increase the need for species to be able to move, so those fragmentation effects will become more important. It will change the nature of habitat, so the degradation issue becomes more important. Just generally, I think that it will exacerbate other forces that are already present.
Well, when I paused before, I think there weren't any other issues that you feel like we've not covered. We've been doing a pretty good.
No, I think we've kind of covered a lot of the issues. Yeah.
Thank you. That's been really great. Really good. Okay. CJ Dennis.
Okay, so CJ Dennis wrote lots of poetry. When was it? The early 1900s. And he has a series on birds. And he's got a fantastic poem on the Indian miner. He's got poems on fairy wrens, poems on magpies, bowerbirds, a whole lot. There's a whole series of poems he did. He wrote for the Age, or was it the Argus? I don't know what it was then. The newspaper, so a regular series of poems. But he's sort of almost a caricaturist in his poems, really getting to the essence of a bird and getting to the essence of an issue. And I find it fascinating from a historical perspective to hear him talking about habitat changes a long time ago, and we're still talking about the same thing now. We're not getting a long way.
Or it is always just going to be an ongoing dynamic.
Yeah, I suppose so. There will always be a conflict between what people want in their places they live and what animals would like in that place as well. Yeah, very true.
And unless we're going to just do away with somehow clear out all the animals, well, it wouldn't possibly, it's not even possible. It shouldn't hopefully be.
Yeah.
I was actually going to ask you, do you have some favourite places in the City of Sydney region where you go to find different birds?
Look, not so much for finding different birds. I sort of grew up right on the edge of Coringa Chase National Park, and I have, very fond memories of that place. I love the sandstone vegetation, love the plants. I love, there's, caves that I used to go and sleep in as a kid and stuff. And so I've got this very strong sense of Hawkesbury sandstone, a white-eared honey eater coming and landing in my head and taking hair from my head for its nest. Not so much birdie places around Sydney, the Hawkesbury sandstone is very important to me. And I love the salt marsh at Tower Point in Botany Bay. I guess that's because I spent my PhD 5 years in a salt marsh, and I love that salt marsh vegetation. And so, there's just a couple of tiny patches left. In Sydney, it's this habitat that's been right on the foreshore, so it's been cleared for industry and drained and reclaimed, and there's not much of it left, but it's got beautiful, subtle colours in it. So it's probably more the habitats than the birds that get me in terms of the places.
Mm. And where do you live?
I live down in the northern suburbs of Wollongong at Colcliff.
Oh, gosh, you live
so I live... was sort of sandwiched between the escarpment and the beach, right on the edge of the bush. So I'm very privileged in the birds that I have. And I was thinking about my morning chorus the day before yesterday, when the first things I heard were two sea eagles carrying on. There's a catbird, a bowerbird, Lewin's honey eater. These were the sort of first sounds I heard in the morning. And I'm thinking it's actually very different from... the constant sound of noisy miners that you hear over most of Sydney.
Mm, yes, good point. Thanks.